Hello, everybody. We've got a really exciting episode of the Second Time Founders podcast. Unfortunately, we are missing our famous lead host, Kevin. He is sick. And so we're going to do our best to make do without him because the show must go on. We have a really special guest today. So this is Sarah, by the way, not Kevin, if you can't tell. But we have a super special guest today, Imad Akund, and I'm going to say his name wrong, and he's going to tell us how to pronounce his name, founder and CEO of Mercury. So maybe can you introduce yourself and Mercury and what it is for those who aren't aware, besides being a planet, what the startup is?
Planet, an element, God.
Right, an element. That's true.
It's funny to hear you talking at normal speed, Sarah, because I only listen to this podcast at 2x. So that's what I'm used to. I'm Imad Akund. I co-founded Mercury in 2017. Mercury is a banking and credit card startup so you can get bank accounts and credit cards for your own startups or e-commerce companies or whatever. And I've been doing startups since 2006. So it's my fourth company. So we need a fourth time founder podcast for that. And I'm also a pretty active investor. I've invested in more than 300 companies, mostly seed stage companies.
Yes, I definitely want to get into asking about your investing and how you find the time to be an active investor. But maybe you could take us back a little bit. Why did you start Mercury? You know, what was the goal or the dream or what led to starting this?
Yeah. My previous startup went on for 8 years, and it was kind of a fairly long and painful journey. We did four full pivots, and I guess we only raised about $8 million. So anyway, we made it last. And, you know, I always had a list of like startup ideas. And one of the kind of classes of startup ideas that I had on the list were like things that every single business uses. So if you think about like payroll, accounting, banking, I guess that's maybe it. I guess there's like communication, like Slack. You know, all of those things kind of sucked when I first started being an entrepreneur in 2006. So everything was painful. And then between 2006 and 2013, when I had this idea, well, a more crystallized idea for Mercury, a lot of those things had improved, right? There was like Slack and Gusto and Stripe and all these things. So yeah, it seemed obvious to me that someone would do the same thing with banking. And then in 2013, I assumed it would be someone else. And then, you know, by 2017, I'd sold that company and I was thinking of like what to do next. And I had this as my kind of top idea that no one had done, which was really surprising to me. So then I kind of went for it.
Yeah, we had Wasim Daher on the podcast, the CEO of Pilot. And he started Pilot because in his previous companies, which he had a few of, you know, he was thinking about what were the pain points, and accounting was one of them. So that was, you mentioned that on your list, but maybe he had already started Pilot by the time you started Mercury. So you had to pick banking. But I agree that as someone who whose company was very impacted by the SVB implosion, banking is a huge pain point, maybe one that I didn't even think was a pain point or realize until that all happened. Did that like SVB implosion impact Mercury in terms of like, did a lot of business come your way, or did, you know, people get scared, or did it really not? I'm wondering if that was like a pivotal growth moment for you guys, or if it really didn't matter that much.
You know, we'd been competing against SVB ever since we launched, right? They were the 800-pound kind of gorilla that's been established for whatever 40 plus years, and you know, was kind of the default banking option for most startups. But we'd, you know, by March 2023, that was about 4 years into the journey, we'd already, I think, made a reasonable headway as like, you know, being the kind of the more product minded, nimble version of SVB for startups. But it was a big, both in the short term, a lot of customers came to us and we had a kind of $2 billion in extra deposits and
Oh, wow. It's
like 8,000 plus extra customers. Yeah. So that was a big deal in the short term. But then now I think, you know, we're seeing us as like kind of the main option for most startups when they're first starting out, right? There's no, you know, most people are not choosing SVB anymore. So it's us or maybe JPMC is the alternative, but that's, you know, not super easy or appropriate to use for most startups. So it's been really good for us in the kind of in the aftermath where like we've become like, you know, the main kind of option for most startups in the US.
So I have my opinion on this, but like what are the main reasons like startups need their own kind of banking platform? They can't just use, you know, their standard bank, like a consumer bank or some business bank,
yeah,
you know, is prominent.
I mean, firstly, for all businesses, like especially SMBs, banking is quite difficult, right? There's lots of fees. You have to walk into a bank branch to do it. And, you know, it's a pretty, yeah, from a product mindset, like actually like a great kind of, you know, beautiful product. Like no one says that about their bank. For startups, it's a little more acute. Startups tend to be bigger, quicker, right? Like if you receive $1 million of funding or 5 million or whatever, you know, at Mercury, we celebrate you. Whereas at a normal bank, they'll be like, wow, this is real suspicious activity. Like what's happening? Right. Why did this like new company suddenly receive $5 million? And because you scale quicker, you need these kind of slightly more advanced features, wires, international payments.
Yeah.
Startups, especially post-COVID, tend to be fairly international in nature. So that comes up quite a lot. But receiving money from investors or customers internationally and sending money to, you know, contractors and suppliers and things like that. But we are open to every business. So actually only about 40% of our customers are startups. But startups is a really good market for us. Most SMBs banking them. And actually, you know, people always say SMBs suck as customers. Most SMBs are not super great customers, but startups are actually great customers for banking because they can scale very quickly, and you know, you can get like a large number of deposits from like a smaller set of customers.
Yeah, I remember when, you know, in the scramble to move out of SVB, we, you know, chose a few banks, and then I had to wire money for one, you know, some bill that we were paying that required a wire, and I had to go visit a branch in person to do that wire because it was too much money to approve, like in their online portal, or maybe they didn't even have an online portal. And I was like, oh my God, this is why we need something like Mercury or what SVB, you know, maybe used to be, because it is like the kind of transactions you have to do as a startup, you know, you're moving lots of money around and, you know, that you can't visit a branch in person every time you need to pay a bill for something. So I love that you brought up SMBs, and especially because you're also an advisor and an investor in other startups. One of the things I always tell founders who have new ideas, when those ideas involve SMBs, I'm like, you know, is there a better market to start with? SMBs are so hard. And, you know, there have been some businesses that have cracked SMBs. QuickBooks is the kind of canonical example. I'm curious, like, both in your experience and also in the advice you give to founders, you know, how to think about selling to SMBs versus other kinds of businesses. Is that like a red flag for you, or how should founders think about that?
You know, one of the funny things is like investors and like the general lore in Silicon Valley is don't do a startup that sells to consumers or SMB. But if you look at like the biggest companies in the world, they're almost all consumer or SMB companies, right? Like Facebook, Google, Shopify, Amazon. So it's kind of like ironic that the biggest companies come from the exact opposite advice that like most people give. And I think that's actually like, that is a causal link. I think because it's hard, if you crack it, you will have an bigger market and an unusual advantage. Like, it's not, you know, this, it's not like lots of people figure it out, like both consumer or SMB. And these markets are huge. Like, both of them are, you know, it's probably like easier to crack, you know, mid-market or enterprise B2B, but because it's easier, there's a lot more competition into it. And you get good and big companies, but they're actually not the trillion-dollar companies or whatever. So I think the trick and the question is, like, if you do want to crack consumer or SMB, like, what is your, you know, what is the way you're going to crack it? Like, you have to really figure out, like, what is your distribution and how will it work? And the best type of distribution, if you can figure out, is like organic distribution. But to have like organic distribution, there has to be a very natural kind of word of mouth or network effect to what you're doing, which, you know, obviously Facebook cracked in consumer. For us, like, one of the reasons we target startups and actually e-commerce companies is, you know, these entrepreneurs have like fairly tight knit kind of communities. And, you know, if you do, and this happens in a lot of entrepreneur kind of startup products, right? Like, actually happened with Vaseem and Pilot, happened with Stripe, happened with Gusto, and then Rippling, and then with Mercury, is that if you build a really, really good product that like caters very specifically to its startups, you can become kind of the main recommended option among startups. So for our first year, or probably even 2 years, like, you know, 90%+ of our growth came from organic and word of mouth, and just people recommending it to their friends. Now it's still 50%, and the scale is much bigger. But yeah, that kind of growth is really nice if you can crack it, because it's free and it's relatively scalable, right? The, if you get a new user, they have like some propensity to share with their friends. And it also aligns with product, right? Like, it, the way to get more word of mouth is to build better product and build better customer experiences. So, which isn't true for like all distribution channels. That's one thing. I think the other thing that has worked for various people in SMB is kind of accounting or bookkeeping based distribution. So you mentioned QuickBooks, Bill.com is the other big example. So it's kind of Gusto and some of these other payroll providers. So, you know, if you go to kind of a trusted advisor or an SMB, you can, you know, go capture them. And then, you know, instead of capturing one SMB at a time, you can get ideally hundreds of them.
Oh, so like distribution through Gusto, for example.
No, I'm saying Gusto partly build distribution via accountants. Like, if you, you know, if you are a bookkeeper and accountant, like, a lot of SMBs turn to their bookkeeper and accountant and say, okay, you know, I just hired my first person, what should I do? And the payroll setup and things like that are often taken care of by the accountant or bookkeeper.
I see. Yeah. I feel like there's kind of this sort of startup stack, and some of that stack gets recommended to you by your, you know, accounting firm or even your legal team. Like, I feel like legal is one of the first things that you might establish as a startup. And so then you kind of ask your lawyer, like, what are the things people do for, you know, payroll and accounting and banking and, you know, all these areas. So once you're part of that kind of like established stack, you're good to go. You know, Carta with your cap table. Like, I remember our investors came to us and were like, can you please put your cap table on Carta? I was like, okay, I guess if that's the established thing to do. And they got this, you know, really strong hold on the market through just getting into that like official startup stack. But, you know, I think there's like now a lot of those sort of core opportunities are being, you know, they've been solved. They're now getting competitive. So it'll be interesting, you know, to see what those next, you know, platform components are to building your startup that are like greenfield opportunities.
Well, the last 2 years, it's also been like not cool to target startups because you know, we've gone through a bit of a VC recession. And my time since 2006, I feel like targeting startups goes from like cool to not cool to cool every like 2 to 4 years. You have to worry about which of those cycles you're in.
Right. And how do you, like, you know, I think a challenge a lot of these products face that sold to startups is like when startups were going through a recession and downsizing, you know, they lost money because either their customers completely closed down or they needed a lot fewer seats. Mm-hmm. Was that, you know, how were you guys impacted by that, or how did you kind of protect yourselves against that?
Yeah, I mean, our growth definitely slowed down. Like if you think about growth as like either spend on your debit or credit card or deposits, you know, deposits are shrinking in the 2021 cohort, especially. Right. And then people are being more careful with spend. You know, we think about like during these downturns, like, you know, we think about like, how do we grow our market share? So even if, you know, the growth in the actual like top line KPIs is not as aggressive as we'd want it, like, are we growing our market share? And obviously, post SVB, our market share has gone up quite a bit. And yeah, you know, these kind of cycles happen. Like, you just have to kind of be prepared to weather them. I think it helps to keep your burn fairly conservative. And we've always been like, you know, we raised a lot of money in 2021 and we've always been fairly conservative. So, you know, we're happy to kind of ride out the cycle and, you know, come out stronger on the other side, hopefully.
Yeah. So let's get into that. So how much money have you raised in total, if you're willing to share that? And what was your latest like series in terms of AB?
Yeah, I think all in, it's about 163 million. Our previous was a Series B that we did in July 2021, I think was the close. That was 120 million at 1.62 billion valuation. But we've been profitable for the last 7 quarters. We actually have more money in the bank than we've ever raised.
That's incredible. So what is your kind of path? Do you want to become a public company? Do you want to sell? Do you want to just be profitable and throw off dividends? I think a lot of founders are curious, like, what, you know, where do these things go and how do people think about it that have, you know, hit Series B and beyond?
Yeah. I'd like to build like a long-term kind of legacy company. That's my focus. So I guess being a public company is part of that. There's no rush. We only actually launched about 5 years ago. So I think there's further to go in terms of us being more mature and predictable as a company. I sold my previous company and that was kind of a painful experience. So I definitely don't want to sell again. At some point being a public company and then, yeah, I guess dividends are kind of funny. There's been a couple of startups that have done dividends recently. There was Do Not Pay that Josh did a dividend recently. And then Sahil from Gumroad has been doing a dividend for a while. It's kind of interesting. I mean, I think for us, like, there's a ton of investment to do. So even though we're profitable, we don't really think about dividends, but it's kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah. I'm curious why selling your business was painful. Was it the actual sale process or was it like having to work for the acquirer that a lot of these sales require?
Honestly, everything about it is pretty bad. So, most of the time, like, I think culture is a really important thing that you create in your company. And it's very unlikely that your culture is compatible with the culture of the company that is acquiring you. And obviously, it's the acquirer. So, like, you end up seceding your culture to theirs. So whatever that is, like, whatever you care about, like, it's no longer going to be that thing at this new company. And then, yeah, it's just hard to go fast. And, you know, in that case, it was a particularly difficult acquisition because it was very much about like them kind of shutting down a product and trying to move our customers over to their product. If we were like direct competitors. So that's obviously like difficult as well, because like you kind of spend years building like your baby and then you have to kind of shut it down and move it to like a product that like felt inferior to us at the time. Yeah. And then the process takes forever. Like we, you know, it took 9 months to go through this acquisition. Like it was a very,
that sounds
very
fast.
Long. It's, yeah, the thing is, it's all existential while you're going through it as well. It's like, you know, I'd been doing startups by that point for 10 years and I never really like had an exit. So
right.
It was a really big deal for me. And like, and when it takes 9 months, I mean, it's not like 9 months of like, oh, let's just do paperwork. It's 9 months of like, oh, like actually we found this problem or like, let's
right.
renegotiate this or like, you know, like we had 1 month where like our numbers didn't grow. Like we actually like had 1 month where we shrunk and they were like, oh no, like you didn't hit your projections. And I'm like, I don't know. Like we grew the month before, like, and then
right.
we, you know, we dipped 1 month and the next month we had a great growth month. But like, it's just 9 months of like actual ups and downs that are like very, you know, very difficult because they're not like just like the startup ups and downs are difficult, but they're still kind of in your control. Like, okay, you're like, you can build product,
right.
you can do things. This is like, you're talking to some third party that has their own motivations and it is a very difficult 9 months. Most people who've gone through acquisitions have a difficult time through it. I'm sure there's some good ones.
Yeah, and most of these acquisitions fall through. Like they don't even make it.
Yeah, that's
it
the thing. Like, there isn't any point during those 9 months where it's guaranteed.
Right. But I imagine like the outcome was decent for you if you're now able to invest in all these startups and like I've got to imagine it was worth it in that sense. Like you got some kind of decent win.
Yeah, it was a good outcome. I mean, I think that is the big benefit of it. Like you get money at the end and that is kind of, before that point, I was still living in a one bedroom and I had a 4-year-old daughter in the one bedroom in San Francisco. So it was nice to kind of have some liquidity and flexibility in life. So that is positive. And like, you know, in that sense, I would probably do it again.
So you brought up your daughter. You have, how many kids do you have and what ages?
I have a 6 and a 12-year-old, both daughters.
Okay. So they've grown. So tell me, like, and, you know, I feel like men are not asked this enough. And I get asked this all the time. So I'm going to ask you, I'm going to turn the tables. Tell me how you balance it all. Like 2 kids, a massively growing company that is not a small business to run, valued at, you know, over $1 billion. It's got to be high pressure. And you're also like investing and advising lots of companies on the side. Like, how do you manage this all?
Yeah, it's a good question. I do actually get asked this quite often. So
good.
It's not just me. I think there's like 2 main factors that like help me manage it. Number one, you know, I used to think, especially early in my entrepreneurship, I was like always like, you know, burn candles on the both ends or whatever. And, you know, if I could work like 13 hours a day, I would work 13 hours a day, et cetera. But what I've found is, A, you know, my 13th hour in the day is not that productive. And actually, like 10 really focused hours in the day is, if I can pull off 10 extremely focused hours, which is even, I would say, hard to do, right? Like, I think you get pretty tired. And I actually realized I was kind of fooling myself a little bit. I was like, oh, you know, I was kind of having lunch while I'm working, reading Hacker News. Like, I'm doing all these things that, like, are not really work, but I'm on my computer pretending that I'm working for those 13, 14 hours. So that was one aspect that, like, actually, like, productivity-wise, like, 10 hours a day, 5 days a week is actually, like, if you can achieve that productively, you're actually in, like, a pretty good space. And, like, the incremental hours, especially over a long period, like, sure, you can, like, rush it for, like, a few weeks because you're launching something or whatever, but I think for an extended period, it doesn't work. And then the second realization I had is that, you know, once you have 10, let's say 10 employees or so, you know, you working an extra hour, let's just say you work an extra 10%, like, but you have 10 employees, that's only 1% extra work that the company's doing. So you're kind of, you know, risking burnout, et cetera, but like you're only providing 1% extra work. You know, unless you're, if you hire strong people that actually like, you know, should be better than you at the things that they focus on. You as a CEO working an extra 1% total time is not going to make much of a difference to the company once it scales. And I've always set up Mercury especially to be in a position where I'm never the bottleneck on most things. I mean, I'm the bottleneck on fundraising and things like that. But yeah, there's, I'm an engineer, but I don't do any engineering. And like most decisions, you know, are made by autonomous people that can do them. So I would say like actually working extra time doesn't give you that much extra productivity is the highlight there. And then the second part is, you know, I don't, like people say like, oh, I run out of time, like I don't have time for this, etc. I'm not like a big believer in ever saying that. Like I think time is not as much of an issue as energy. And doing things that energize you is like doesn't cost that much time, in my opinion. Like doing like 3 hours of like boring, painful things is way, way harder than 3 hours of like, or 10 hours of like things that like you enjoy doing and energizes you, etc. So a lot of the things that I do that are not work related to me are like give me energy. So like spending time with my kids or like talking to founders and helping them. Like, you know, I do invest quite a bit, but I mostly do it just to like talk to founders and learn interesting things and like help them. And yeah, that stuff is not very draining for me. So that's kind of my perspective on that.
Well, that gives me hope. I feel like my kids are just starting to get to the ages where they give me energy some of the time. So I have a 8, 6, and 4-year-old. The 4-year-old is still very much energy draining.
Yeah.
Like when I hang out with just my girls, 8 and 6, I start to, you know, feel that like motivation. They don't require as much just like pure energy and exertion to manage. So I see the light that one day my kids and being with my family will bring me energy. But I agree. Like I started doing these intro calls, thanks to this podcast mostly. We had the founder of Intro on the podcast. And I mean, I do, you know, maybe 1 or 2 a week and they're like 15 minutes long. So they're short, but it has been awesome to like talk to founders, especially in the earliest stages. Like they are they're so ambitious. They're so hopeful. And they're thinking about a lot of things that I don't necessarily get exposure to. You know, I'm so focused on Winnie and what we're working on. And it helps to kind of look outside, think about other people's problems and the challenges they're facing. I feel like it brings me just a little bit something back to the company when I'm like kind of going outside our bubble and like, oh, wait, they are using that cool AI tool or they're thinking about a problem that way. Like maybe we should be looking at that. So I love that like energy analogy and doing things that bring you energy, which isn't always possible, especially as a parent.
Yeah. Even like, I think parenting things, you can try to be like deliberate about it to go like, okay, you know, like I'm not that much. I mean, obviously my kids are a little older, but I'm, you know, some people are like, oh, you should be doing X or Y with your kids. And I'm like, you know, if I don't enjoy doing that, I'm not going to bring it my all. So I try to construct my time with the kids doing things that I actually enjoy doing as well. So, you know, I like sports. So like playing sports or something is like much more fun than like, I don't know, watching Bluey for the 500th time. So, yeah, in the time that I do spend with the kids, I try to fill it with things that like actually, like I try to be deliberate about how to like do things that I enjoy as part of that.
Yeah, I've never like sat down to watch any of these like junky videos my kids watch. And the other parents will like bring up like, oh, do you know this character in Bluey? I'm like, I could not pick Bluey out of a lineup. I have no, when they're in the videos, like, that's my time.
He's blue.
But no idea. See, like, a cat, a mouse, like, no clue.
Actually, I don't know what kind of animal he is.
Because, yeah, I do not get any energy from watching Bluey or whatever junk they're now watching. But that probably makes me a bad parent for not supervising what they're watching. No idea. Okay, so something Kevin loves to ask, and he will be mad at me if I don't ask you, is like the craziest founder story that you have. So, you know, a time when you thought, you know, maybe Mercury was done for, or you maybe met some crazy celeb and you were like, how can I be doing this right now? Just something that, like, you know, gives people a little bit of behind the scenes that they may not read about in the press, that you experienced as a founder. If you have any kind of crazy founder story.
Yeah, I don't know.
Time thing when
too crazy.
Horribly wrong or horribly great. Or yeah, you were just like,
I have a funny story. This was 2017, and we were going into a kind of a partners meeting and in recent Horowitz. So, you know, they did end up becoming our seed investors. I guess that's the punchline to the story. But, you know, as part of my kind of process, whenever I go to Sand Hill Road for a partners meeting, I always go to the Starbucks there to get like a latte, you know, get myself kind of settled in and show up early.
I've spent so much time at that Starbucks.
So I went there, I got my latte, and, you know, just as I'm about to drink it, like, I basically didn't put the lid on fully. Lid was loose because I just put sugar in there. And I poured this latte all over my shirt. And at this point, I only have like 5 minutes to get to the partners meeting. So I like go to the restroom, dry it out as much as possible.
Wait, but did you still say your shoe or your shirt?
My shirt. It's like completely wet. This isn't like a small thing. This is like half a latte is more than my shirt. But then I dry it out and, you know, it's a gray shirt, but this is like a big brown stain on like half the shirt. So I was like, you're always nervous with these partners meetings anyway. So I was like really going, oh shit, like now what? But like there was no time left. So we showed up and thankfully, and I could not believe this was the case. They had this kind of presentation set up where the room was completely dark, not completely dark, but like very dark. Because the screen was on and this is a room with like 20 people. Anyway, I show up, I'm feeling very self-conscious, but it's like a dark room.
Wow.
And then I went through this whole pitch and then, you know, everyone's asking me questions and Mark Andreessen's there, but he's not said anything. And I'm like, oh man, he must hate the pitch. And like, maybe he saw my shirt because he's like sitting right in front of me. And then, so apparently he does this thing where he like if he always does this, but he said in this one, he like let everyone else ask a question. And then he was like, oh, when everyone's finished, then he goes on, like, then he spends the last like 10 minutes of this, like, partners meeting, just like drilling me with like questions. And they ended up investing. So it was fine in the end, but that was like a pretty crazy story.
That is pretty lucky that the room was dark. I feel like that. Yeah. That was a good.
I would have just, I guess, admitted to it if it wasn't. I don't know what I would have done.
I feel like everyone has these stories with like clothing. Like, just got to keep an extra set of clothing just in case.
Oh yeah, maybe. I mean, this is the only time this has happened to me. But
it's always right before these meetings that these things happen. So, you know, you've raised from a number of prominent investors, including Andreessen Horowitz. Like, any tips? Is it just your awesome accent that gets people, you know, investing? Or do you have anything that you do that you think really helps kind of get the Andreessen Horowitzes of the world investing in you?
Yeah. I mean, firstly, I have failed at fundraising a lot as well. So, you know, I did. Like Hayzap, my previous startup, you know, we did a Series A in 2011 and then we went till 2016 when we sold it, but it wasn't like I wasn't trying to raise almost every year in that time. So I think I learned a lot in that time period, but it's not like a given that I'm always great at fundraising. In terms of tips, yeah, I think it's good to have an audacious idea, like having a big vision and a big idea, like, you know, we're going to build banking for startups, like especially in 2017, that was like a very unusual and audacious idea. And that really helps. Sometimes I talk to entrepreneurs and, you know, they have like kind of one idea and that they have this other more audacious kind of version of it. And I think like I try to encourage people to pitch the bigger idea and the bigger vision. Because at the end of the day, especially at seed and series A, like, you know, they're basically, it's your very low probability of a very high outcome. That's kind of the math. So you want to really make sure that the high outcome is really big. So that's one thing. I think the second thing that really helped after I kind of became an investor is I realized that a lot of the time, of the 10 years before I started investing, I was kind of treating the investor as a kind of like a authority figure, parent type person, if you know right. what I mean. Like I was like, oh, you know, tell us what to do. And like, do you like this idea? What do you think? Like it was very like submissive. And I realized actually as an investor, I hate it when entrepreneurs treat me like that. Like I want to be like, hey, we're doing this together. We're partners. I want you to, like, I don't know, as an investor, I have no freaking idea what the hell these people are talking about, right? Like if someone comes to me and it's like, hey, should we be doing this? I'm like, I don't know. You've thought about this for years and I'm only like 30 minutes into this conversation. So yeah, even though it might feel to you as an entrepreneur that you should be like really like, oh, asking them for advice and all these things, like actually, I mean, obviously you want to do a bit of that, especially when they know something that's relevant. But a lot of the time, actually, you should be treating your investors, either prospective investors or existing investors, as partners. And that's a very different perspective. And I think that like has helped Mercury raise money because I think my perspective has been very different while we've raised money.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, I think the best investors also understand that there's a lot that they don't know and they're not in the business day to day. And, you know, they try not to act like they're the CEO or that they know more than the CEO. Because no podcast would be complete without talking about AI, I'm curious, like, how you guys use AI in your business, either in, you know, the operational aspects, in the actual product. Is it something you're thinking a lot about, or, you know, how do you think about AI?
Yeah. I mean, AI is exciting. So I think about it quite a lot. And I'd say like most of the investments I've made in the last kind of year have been either AI first or some significant AI portion to them.
Nice.
And that's like, you know, you were talking about like learning things that you can bring back to your company. And I think that's like been a useful element from those investing. I think generally actually in fintech, AI is mostly a back office thing rather than like customer facing things. There's some like fintech customer facing applications for it, but I think it's like fairly minimal. And like the cost of hallucinations is like very expensive in fintech. So like, I think it'll take a little bit longer and though, you know, you're going to need more maturity before you adopt too much generative AI. But on the back office side, you know, one of the hidden costs to any fintech company is like customer service and ops. Like those costs are like actually pretty significant. And if you can, you know, have 30% of your customer support tickets answered or at least like pre-drafted an answer to it, like that's a pretty big win. So that's where we have kind of invested and we think there'll be most of our investments in the future.
Is that like a homegrown solution or are there any tools that you found particularly useful in like the customer service and ops side of things?
So far, we've mostly done things ourselves and just, you know, used kind of direct, mostly open AI kind of LLM implementations. I think over time, especially on the customer service side, there's a ton of startups kind of innovating. Again, it's almost better to wait a little bit and because there's so much innovation happening that like I think the winners in the customer support space in like
I'm 12 months like time will be HubSpot, different. Which we use for our customer service, will like integrate something. Right now they don't really have anything kind of off the shelf. But I'm like, they have so much data from all of these tickets that we've answered.
It's hard to imagine that like the incumbents won't do a good enough job. And yeah, you have to imagine they have like a team working on it today.
I guess we now, I feel like there's a lot that, like, if we just wait a little bit longer, we can have just it built into the tools we're already using instead of trying to, you know, build a whole solution ourselves. We obviously use a lot of like ChatGPT in our operations at Winnie and, you know, their APIs.
I think it's
automate stuff, but a lot of these tools, it's like yet another tool who you'll have to start using.
I think for established startups, it's like a pretty different equation. You kind of have to like step back and say, is this an existential issue? Like, if I don't do this AI thing, will I get disrupted by some startup? Because like they're a AI first version of like us. And, you know, I don't think that's true for Mercury or Winnie, that there's like AI first version of us that like would win. And then if there is an AI first version of you that win, then it's like mostly, like, it's tempting to just wait because these things are just getting better. Like GPT-5 was going to answer more support tickets than GPT-4 did. So like, you know, any optimizations you make to GPT-4 might be just like a waste of time. There has been a few companies that I've been a part of that like, or invested in that, like pivoted to becoming AI kind of first companies and have been successful in pulling that off, or at least have been successful in fundraising because of that angle. But I think for most companies that are like established, it's worth waiting. One thing that is kind of interesting, and you know, I don't know if you've thought about it much, but we have done a little bit on it, is to get better data. Like, you know, if you already have distribution and data, then like applying AI, especially as it improves, is going to be better. And for us, like, you know, part of the reason we launched a corporate credit card a year and a half ago, we were just in banking and then we launched a credit card, is that a lot of your kind of spend data as a company happens through a credit card. If we want to build interesting, at that point we were thinking more analytics type things, but also AI, like if you want to answer a question of like, where did I spend the most last month? You kind of need bank data and credit card data, to do that. So it's kind of interesting to think about like how you get better data to build future AI applications.
Yes. Yeah. That, you know, I think there's like all the stuff that AI now enables for our business. And then, you know, thinking about, well, what could actually just make things easier today? And yeah, should we just replace or enhance with AI? I'm curious, are there any, you know, investments you made or things you've seen that you want to recommend to founders, like tools or anything out there that people should know about, or is everything just kind of early?
Well, I've done so many. I found this one's pretty good, and they actually announced recently. I'm always worried about pre-announcing someone. Are they even live?
But we can cut it out if you look after.
This company called OpenPipe, that's really cool. So I'm quite into kind of open source LLMs being the future. And OpenPipe makes it so like they take your existing kind of calls to OpenAI, but let you kind of fine tune them and like swap them out for like an open source LLM. But I've done a bunch of investments in kind of open source LLM kind of infrastructure plays, just because I think that's the way most companies will deploy LLMs, in my opinion.
Interesting. Well, as we hit the end of our time together, is there anything we didn't cover? Any parting words of advice for founders? Anything that you want our audience of mostly first-time founders to know?
This is my kind of go-to advice when I'm asked this question, which is like, yeah, you should try to construct your life so you enjoy the journey. I think as an entrepreneur, it's often tempting to like think about the destination, like an exit or a fundraise, or like you're always like, oh, if when we do this, I'll feel good. But you know, it can take years to get there. And if you're not enjoying your life on the way there, and constructing your life in a way where you can do it like in a sustainable way, then what's the point? So anyway, that's my That's my words of wisdom.
Because this interview is coming at you from, I'm in Mexico right now, enjoying my life. My kids are on spring break and we are at a resort that has childcare. So
nice.
I am being a true like digital nomad right now and working from Mexico. But this was so awesome. How can people find you on the internet? What are the best ways to reach you?
Yeah. And Curie? I'm Imad on Twitter or X. I'm also trying to get this whole LinkedIn thing happening. So you can follow me on LinkedIn too.
Nice. Are you a LinkedIn influencer?
I guess so. I don't really understand who reads the LinkedIn feed, but apparently people do that. So,
oh my God. I think this LinkedIn is like the new like hot product. What was once old and crufty is now like everyone is switching to LinkedIn. So yeah, I think it's the place to be. Awesome. Well, all right. Well, we'll find you on X and LinkedIn. How can we find Mercury?
Just mercury.com.
Wow. Okay. You got the .com from the planet and the element. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and see you all next time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Hopefully Kevin recovers quickly.
Yeah. We wish Kevin well.